Hey, podcast listeners, Michael Shelley here. Today, two guests for you. First, we have Rod Argent of The Zombies, and I want to remind you that a couple years ago, I interviewed Colin Blunstone of The Zombies, so if you get curious for more Zombies information, check out the archives over at WFMU.org, and you can hear the full Colin Blunstone interview. It was pretty interesting, and this one's short. I actually recorded this one in my house because of Rod's availability, so I edited it a tiny bit, but one of the things I edited out is where he gets another phone call from another interview, because ours ended up going longer than we had scheduled for, and so this one got cut short. So if you need more Zombies information, head to WFMU.org/Michael and hear the Colin Blunstone interview. But this is a really good interview. Really enjoyed this one. Anytime the guests laugh, I always think that's a good sign. And then after Rod, we've got Bobby Patterson, longtime soul man, been making records, you know, more than 50 years, and his new one is pretty good. It's very good, actually, and for a contemporary soul record, that is a rare thing. So we're going to hear all about that from both of those guys. Next week, it is P.F. Sloan, that's who it is. And then I'm going on vacation for a while. Maybe I'll throw on some reruns there, but I've got 3 weeks when I'm on vacation, so nothing new in those 3 weeks, but perhaps something old. We'll see. Here it is, my interview with Rod Argent. Rod Argent, good morning and welcome to WFMU. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you, Michael?
I'm doing great. I know you guys are in the middle of a tour, and it's been, you know, over 50 years. You're going to be at B.B. King's next Friday, the 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, I mean, how is a tour these days different from touring, you know, in your heyday in the mid-60s?
Well, several differences, really. When we first toured, I remember the very first time we came over to the States was the Murray the K Christmas show at the Brooklyn Fox. And that was, we opened at 8 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Day, 1964. And we did something like 8 shows a day, but we only played 2 songs, along with everybody else. But that's how things were done then, you know. And I always remember, it wasn't just us, but we had to do all sorts of other things. Like when we'd done our 2 songs, we had to stand at the back of the stage for the rest of the show and kick our legs up in the air behind the other bands. And everyone had to do that, which is really bizarre. So that's pretty different to what we do now, I can tell you. A lot of things are exactly the same. There's no way of getting around touring a big country like the US without traveling long distances. The road, we tend to prefer to travel by road these days because it's such a business traveling by plane now. In the old days, you used to be able to walk on the plane about 10 minutes before it took off and treat it like a bus. But of course, with all the terrorism and the problems that you have now, you know, you can't do that anymore. So that's very different. The things that are very much the same are the feeling you get from the energy of playing on stage and what you get back from the crowd. That, you know, it's such a privilege to be part of this business, in the sense that you can be as ancient as we are and yet go on stage and feel like you're 18 years old. And the feeling when you're playing on stage and the energy that you feel as you're playing and what you get back is entirely the same as when you were 18 and 19 years old. And I tell you, that's a privilege.
I have seen the Zombies in the past few years, and you can tell, I think, from the audience, there's a give and take, you know, that the audience is feeding the band and the band is then feeding the audience, and it builds, you know, it's really an exciting show. And the songs, of course, are wonderful. And obviously, it's still fun for you.
It's I honestly, you know, I know people say this, but it's the 100% truth. As far as Colin and I are concerned, we would not do this if it wasn't fun for us. We're doing it because of the buzz that we get out of playing. And playing with a great band, I have to say. You know, it is, I say every night when we introduce the band at the end of the evening, but it's true. It's the privilege of being able to play in front of a great band every night and continue to do new material along with, you know, loving continuing to do all the old material. We don't stint on that. But it's very important to us to feel there's creative energy there and to be able to get excited about new material too. So it's we would not do it if we didn't still feel that buzz.
You mentioned spending Christmas Day at a theater and starting at 8 a.m. And I think you were still teenagers at that time, right?
I've just written a song for the new album about that first trip and our first exposure to New York. And one of the lines said, when I was a young man, still inside 19. Yeah, we were still inside 19 years old when we first came over.
Did your mind just go nuts? And who else was on the bill? Who else did you see 8 times?
It was wonderful for us, you know, because along with many other UK musicians at the time, we were in love with a lot of the black music of the time. You know, people like Benny King and the Drifters, who were on the show with us. Patti LaBelle was on the show with us. There was some great white acts as well, and we played with the Shangri-Las. But it was wonderful, and I loved the way that the people like Patti really took to us, and they were very generous and sweet to us, and introduced us to the music of so many people, including Aretha Franklin, Nina Simone, you know, people that were just giants and we hadn't heard of at that time. But the people on the bill, it was great. In fact, strangely enough, the headliner, because he was so big in New York at that moment, was Chuck Jackson. It was great.
Do you happen to remember what you got paid?
I do, and it was virtually nothing. and the reason, I mean, I've got to be careful what I say here, really, but we had a we had a real division in our luck because we had a wonderfully honest setup as far as our producers were concerned for the records, and they'd least take the records, so they retained ownership of the records, which came to us. So which means we can now, you know, decide where they go all this time later. They were also our publishers, and they were 100% honest. So everything to do with the writing and the recording, we got paid 100%, which was wonderful. Now, the division is that on the live side of things, I believe we were pretty badly ripped off, along with many other people at the time, of course. And we, you know, throughout our career, even with some very big hit records, we virtually made no money from live. I mean, we made a bit, but nothing significant from live playing. I'll defer the question a little bit by saying, or deflect the question a little bit by saying that almost the last live thing we did wasn't in America, it was in the Philippines. And the way it was presented to us was that, do you want to see a bit of the East before you break up? Because I can guarantee that you'll be put up in a good accommodation, and I can guarantee you won't lose money. And we got over there, and we were the biggest thing ever to hit the Philippines. We were as big as the Beatles. We had 10 records in their top 20 at the time when we got over there. We played to 40,000 people a night for a 10-night residency. And we got paid £80 a night between us, which is, you know, you can work that out. It's about $100-something a night.
Yeah. That's amazing. The band started to form in 1962. It's been more than 50 years. Your first hit, 1964, She's Not There, was number 12 in the UK, number 2 in the USA. And that's a huge, huge hit. And I believe it was the second song you ever wrote. Is that right?
It's the second song I ever wrote. Now, I must, if you don't mind, just slightly correct a couple of things in the story. We actually formed in 61, believe it or not, even earlier than you said.
Wow.
When we were 15 years old, before our 16th birthday, we formed. You're absolutely correct. It made number 12 in the UK. In the US, we always like to call it a number one because there were two equivalent magazines at the time. One was Cashbox, one was Billboard. And I know Billboard has retained its, you know, supremacy, but Cashbox was equal to it at the time. In Cashbox, we were number one, Mike. But in Billboard, you were quite right, we're number two.
No, I don't want to take away a number one hit from you. Absolutely.
No, you can't do that. You can't do that to us. And later on, in Cashbox, Time of the Season was number one as well, and I believe it was number two or three in Billboard. So I'm not going to have that one taken away from.
So you put out your first record, Begin Here, and there's some covers on there and some original songs. How did you pick the covers? Were these songs you listened to as a kid? Were these 45s you were collecting? How did you guys build that choice of cover songs?
Well, mainly through panic, because at the time, albums were afterthoughts to singles, and you only made an album if you had a hit single. And of course, you know, She's Not There, which you're right, was the second song I ever wrote, or maybe technically the third, because I'd forgotten about a very early sort of derivative of the Beatles song that I'd written called The Lonely One. I'd forgotten that for years until it surfaced, recorded by another band, actually, strange enough. When we had the hit with She's Not There, our producer called us up and said, look, I think it'd be a good idea to have an album, you know, on the back of the single. And he said, I booked some time in a week's time. And, you know, I had a couple of songs that I'd written. Chris had a couple of songs that he'd written. And we had to make up the rest of the tracks. The whole album was recorded in 2 days, as was the way of things in those days. We did some covers that we were doing on stage, including Can't Nobody Love You, the Solomon Burke song, including, now I'll tell you a little story about Got My Mojo Working, which I sang, and I used to sing that on stage, and it went down great on stage, and we recorded it, and for some reason, I decided I was going to try a completely different approach on the vocal, and I sang it, and I came in, and we listened to the playback. I said, oh, I hate it, just let me go back and sing it how I normally sing it, one more take, and the producer said, no, that's it, next track, and he wouldn't allow me to do one retake. You know, it was done that quickly. Huh. So really, it was just whatever, you know, we had two or three songs, you know, Chris and I, that we were writing, and we managed to get ready for the following week. But apart from that, it was whatever we were doing on stage. And we were generally given just one or at the maximum two takes to record these things.
Yeah, it really is sort of a testament, though, to how tight and how amazing a live band you must have been at that time, because it's a powerhouse of a record.
Well, it's we were good live, and we built up a real following locally before we turned professional, and we always loved playing live, and which we still do, still absolutely adore playing live, and so I hope I'm not being immodest, but I think we were very good live, yeah.
I'll bet. I want to remind folks, we're talking to Rod Argent. RodArgent.com is his website, or thezombies.net, and they're in the middle of a tour, New York, Maryland, all over New York State, really, and then out to California, and so check the website to see if you're coming that way. Tell Her No is your next big hit in 64-65, goes to number 6 in the USA, only number 42 in the UK, which kind of blows my mind.
I believe the reason for that is that the follow-up, which was put out immediately after She's Not There in the UK, was a song called Leave Me Be, which has never been my favourite track, personally. I mean, I love a lot of Chris Wyatt's writing, but neither Colin nor I ever liked that track. And we thought and we were fairly dismayed, actually, I remember both Colin and I listening to the record just before it was put out and thinking, why have they put this record out? They just rushed anything quickly out, and it was the wrong, I believe to this day, that it was very much the wrong atmosphere for a record to follow up with She's Not There. And in the States, because it was such a flop in the UK, in the States they didn't release it, and they released Tell Her No, which I believe was a much better follow-up. But by that time we had a real flop in the UK, and I think that was one of the reasons that we never really had another hit in the UK, although around the world we had many hits in many countries. But I believe that was a bit of the kiss of death for us in the UK.
Let's talk about the recording of Tell Her No, just the sound of that record, just sonically. It is so overwhelmingly perfect. You know, it's just a pop song, and it's surprising, and you know, melodically, and just the instrumentation, the arrangement, the vocal performance, of course. It's just, for me, that is the ultimate Zombies track there. How I assume that's a little longer than a few hours or one take.
Oh yeah. Well, no, it's not longer than a few hours. No, it was recorded, like everything we did at the time, it probably took, to be honest, Mark, it probably took about an hour to record, or maybe an hour and a half. And in fact, at the time, when Colin was falling asleep while we were recording the backing track, and then Ken woke him up and said, come on, Colin, it's time for your vocal. And Colin went into the studio, and I guess he was still not 100% awake, and he did a great vocal, but there's a little bit in the middle where he goes, he couldn't remember the words, and he sort of slurs over some of the words. And he then came back in, like I did, with got my mojo working, and said to Ken, I've got to redo that middle bit, because I just forgot the words. And Ken said, no, that's fine, honestly. So it just goes to show you. But we did. We loved the feeling of that track, and we were very happy with it. And I also remember, while we were recording Tell Her No, there was a phone call from America, from Al Gallico, who was our publisher in America, and saying, She's Not There is number one, right as I speak. And we were completely knocked out. And that was, of course, as I said earlier, Michael, that was a cash box position. But it was number one in America as we were recording Tell Her No.
Yeah, amazing. So like you said, you know, there was this kind of weird momentum for the band. I'm looking at the singles you guys released in Whenever You're Ready and Just Out of Reach and Friends of Mine and Care of Cell 44 and This Will Be Our Year and even Time of time of the season originally, none of those were hits. Of course, to me, those are all hits. How could those have not been hit records, you know? And eventually, the time of the season, you know, the second record, it's kind of a long story, but eventually Odyssey and Oracle is released in 1968, and Time of the Season becomes a hit in 1969, and really the band has already broken up by that point.
Well, we had, and I have to say that one of the reasons we recorded an album ourselves, produced it ourselves, was because we were becoming very upset about, we felt that the production on some of the singles and the mixing was not as good as it could have been, because we thought that the producer was, rather than taking each of the songs and just getting the best out of them, he was trying to concentrate on, he was an old school producer, and he was thinking, what made She's Not There a hit? Or maybe it was Colin's breathy voice, which, you know, Colin's voice was wonderful on it, but, you know, rather than just take the track as it was and get the best out of it, he was maybe trying to fashion it in a certain way. And we were getting frustrated with that. And that's one of the reasons we recorded an album ourselves, produced it ourselves. And, of course, Time of the Season was the hit, which Chris White and I produced. It had our own ideas on it and our own ideas of how it should sound. And I believe that has something to do with it, because I think that even things like She's Coming Home, you know, we do that on stage sometimes now. And I think that could have been a monster record. I just don't think the actual sound on it was as good as it could have been. The actual, you know, it was just a little bit empty to my ears. Mm. And it could have been recorded better. And it could have had more beef in it. It could have been more natural and more honest and just a bit meatier and more natural. So I think while Ken, our producer, did a wonderful job on the first session that he did with us, on some of the subsequent sessions, it left a bit to be desired. But then on Odyssey and Oracle, there were one or two tracks that I couldn't believe weren't hits, like Carousel 44, I always thought should have been a hit.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you know. But as you said, Time of the Season made up for it, and that was the biggest hit we ever had.
Yeah. I believe it. Is it Jeff Emmerich who's engineering Odyssey and Oracle?
Jeff did some of the engineering on it. He certainly did Time of the Season. But there was a guy called Peter Vince also. Both Jeff and Peter had been recording Sgt. Pepper immediately before Odyssey and Oracle. We virtually walked in as the Beatles walked out. So we had the advantage of some of the technical advances that the Beatles had pioneered. And actually, some of their instruments, I used John Lennon's Mellotron on our album that was being left in the studio.
Amazing. It is really amazing that, you know, Time of the Season, Tell Her No, She's Not There are three songs that, despite their chart position, have endured in ways that not all songs from the era endure. They are, you know, perpetually played on radio and used in soundtracks and things like that. Did you ever foresee that? Did you ever dream of that?
No, we didn't. And one of the reasons why, you know, the first thing we talked about was how quickly, and as an afterthought, the first album, Begin Here, was recorded. It was because at the time everything was thought to be totally disposable, and the thought of that I might be playing along with Colin She's Not There and still enjoying playing it you know, more than 50 years after we first recorded it, would have been madness, you know, in the same way as John Lennon said, I don't expect to be singing rock and roll when I'm 30 years old, you know. I can't believe that things have lasted as they have, and the fact that some kids today still feel that what we did is has some relevance to them, you know, when they listen to it now, it's just so flattering and such a bonus for us.
Yeah, it is amazing that even the Beatles, in the middle of the height of Beatlemania, there's an interview where George says, I think I might open a business when this is all over, and Ringo says, I'm going to open a hair salon or something. You know?
I remember saying saying to somebody, it might have been when I first met my wife, saying, do you know what, if I can earn enough money so that I, you know, I could buy a little, I don't know, bed and breakfast place somewhere so that there's, you know, so that I could continue to have some income. And the thought that, you know, thank somebody up there that that things are still being played a lot now, and it's given me a cushion of income, which has given me freedom to be able to continue to write and do what, you know, what I really want to do. It's just such a privilege.
So Time of the Season becomes a big hit, and there's kind of a scramble to put together a follow-up third album, and it's sort of just been released now, in a way. There's a new Zombies release called R.I.P. that puts together what might have been that third album, and there's a lot of amazing stuff on there.
Well, thank you, and we enjoyed doing it, but really, I have to say, that's one of the things that, you know, whereas everything we do now is generated from us, that was really generated by people saying, you can't just break up and not have any other record out. You know, we'd broken up anyway, and I'd already started to form Argent. But we did it really in response to people saying, you know, there's a big demand out there for stuff. So we did record further stuff. But really, our minds had moved on because, as you so rightly said, it was 18 months after we recorded Odyssey and Oracle and we'd broken up and everything, that Time of the Season was a hit. So by that time, Chris Wyatt, the original bass player in the band, had formed Argent with me as a non-playing member. So we continued to go forward like that. Chris and I had also produced a very well thought of solo album by Colin Brunstone that had a couple of very big hits in Europe and UK on it. An album called 1 Year, and further albums with Colin. So the R.I.P. and the ones that followed up after that were really in response to, you know, publishers and people saying, oh, you can't just leave it, you have to do things. It's not that we didn't enjoy doing it, but it was a little bit off the main path, I should say.
Yeah, I think it's not quite a Zombies album, but it still fits in the Zombies family of music.
Yeah.
So the band broke up, and then throughout the years got back together, and the latest album, Breathe Out, Breathe In, from 2011, really sounds like Zombies music to me. And you've been on the road, as you say, just because you enjoy it. And you're back on the road, back to BB King's this Friday and on tour. Folks can check thezombies.net or rodargent.com for information. Let's end with your favorite Zombie song of all time. What is it?
Oh, my goodness. Now, that is extremely hard. Do you know what? In some ways, we still like to look forward. I would almost choose something from the new album, but I'm not going to. I'm going to go back. I'm going to be very boring and obvious, and not just from a musical point of view, but because it was the thing that felt so magical, and it was the first thing we ever heard on the radio, of course, by us, and it was a hit all around the world. I'm still going to choose She's Not There. I'm sorry to be too obvious.
No, you can't argue with a classic. Rod Argent, thanks for joining us. Let's hear She's Not There. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Mike.
That is brand new from our guest today, Bobby Patterson, from his new record called I Got More Soul. Your Love Belongs Under Rock. Bobby Patterson has been a record producer. He's worked for Malico doing promotion. He's been an AM radio DJ. He's been a songwriter whose songs have been covered by lots of folks, tons of folks. And he made all these great records out of the Dallas area. And he's coming to New York soon. And he joins us here on the telephone. I'm happy to have you on the program. Good morning, Bobby Patterson. How are you feeling?
Well, thank you for having me, Michael. I feel great. I'm walking on the dirt, and the dirt ain't walking on me.
Well, I'm happy about that. I would not want
to. And I can't wait to get to New York. sure, because I am the hip-hop great-grandpop, and I will not stop till the casket drops.
Ouch! You're going to be here Sunday, August 10th, playing a free show at Lincoln Center out of doors. It's going to be a lot of fun. You're based in Dallas, Texas. That's where you sort of came up. What were you listening to as a kid? What was the music that kind of made you think, I'm going to be in the music business?
Well, when I was a kid, you know, the only music shows we had all day Sunday, they had country and western shows, Porter Wagner and Buck Owens and the Grand Ole Opry all day long on Saturday from 8 o'clock in the morning till 12 o'clock at night. And I used to sit and watch the country and western artists, and I love the way that country writers write, so I incorporated a lot of that into my soul music, a la Joe Tex. You know, Joe Tex is from Navasota, Texas, and we kind of grew up playing all kinds of music, especially country music and soul music.
Yeah, I hear that. I definitely hear that. And we've been hearing this morning a bunch of your great 60s stuff and some of your new stuff, and it's all been sounding good. You know, and getting ready for this interview, you know, I read a lot of articles that said things like Bobby Patterson was all but forgotten by the 90s. Is that true? Is that how you feel?
All but forgotten?
Yes.
No. I've been still around. I just I got into the other side of the business. I've done everything practically you can do in the music business. I've been an A&R man. I've been a promotion man. I've been a writer, a producer, and I've also been a DJ at KKDA in Dallas. So I've run the scope of the business, and you know, this is my first CD back in a long time, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to make a CD that sort of sounds contemporary but still has that classic soul sound, and I really think you've done it with I Got More Soul. It really sounds terrific. It's hard to do.
Well, thank you. What we tried to do was incorporate some of the older stuff that I did. I got two songs on there that I've written that other people recorded. Everybody's Got a Little Devil was recorded by Tommy Young back in 1971. I produced and wrote that song, and so I've never sang it myself. On this album, I sang that song, and I also sung a song that I did on Fontella Bass back in the 70s called It's Hard to Get Back In, so I did that myself. And, you know, Albert King has recorded some of my music. That's what the blues is all about. The Fabulous Thunderbirds, which are Steve Ray and Jimmy and them used to come sit in the band when I was growing up. You know, I had a band, and they'd come around and sit in and everything. They did How Do You Spell Love that I wrote. So I'm doing some of the songs that I wrote and produced on other people. I'm doing them myself. And Your Love Belongs Up Under a Rock by the Dirt Bombs was Zach's idea, and we did that. And I think the album is kind of down, you know, the middle. I tried to hit the middle stream, you know, because I ain't no old school, I ain't no new school. I'm smack dab in the middle, like Y.A. Tittle.
Well, it's, like I said, very successful. I think a lot of people know you from a string of 45s you put out mostly in the 1960s on the ABNAC and Jetstar labels, on the Jewel Paula labels. There's some really great stuff in there. Tell me about the nightclub scene, the soul music scene around Dallas, Texas in the 1960s. What was it like?
Well, it was me and Ray Sharp and Freddie King and Johnny Taylor. We all lived in the Dallas area, and we all played the nightclubs, the Beachcomber, the Blackout, Luann's, and places like that. You know, there were plenty of places to do soul music, and we played 7 or 8 nights a week, and just had a ball, and people would come around and sit in. You know, people like Sam Samudio, who put out the Woolly Bully. They called himself Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs. You know, he's from West Dallas. And he used to come around, and I let everybody sit in and learn the craft in my band. So we just had a ball. That's what it was, you know? Yeah. And I'm coming to New York to show everybody that old dogs still know how to bury the bone.
I've heard that your show these days is like nobody else's, and that you are certainly young at heart. So, yeah, I recommend everybody comes out and sees you. That's Lincoln Center Out of Doors, Sunday, August 10th, and website lcoutofdoors.org for information about that. And like we said, it's free, so there's no excuse not to go see Bobby Patterson, right?
That's right, and I hope you can make it, Michael, because I come to get people jab-slapped and woke up out of your nap. I'm going to jump down your throat and tap dance on your bladder, come out your toes and ask you what's the matter.
Ouch! your biggest hit, I think, was TCB or TYA, went to number 36 in the R&B charts, 1969, on the wonderful Jetstar label, home of Floyd Dakel, another one of my favorites. Now, I've read a few different things about what TCB or TYA actually stands for. Can you give us the lowdown? What does it really stand for?
Well, back in the day, I think I cut that in 68 or something like that. You know, we couldn't say a lot of things that you say on records today. And it was, take care of business or tear your ass. But we said turn yourself around, because back in those days, you know, that it was kind of not good to say that. So, you know, it's a permissible word now, and everybody uses it on radio and television. So that's what that really means. Everybody asks me that. Is what is TCB or TYA? Take care of business or tear you.
Your band, The Mustangs, was super hot, as is evidence on those records that we heard. Just like, you know, as good as the James Brown Band, very funky, very soulful, great band. I imagine you guys played a lot of frat parties, a lot of nightclubs. Tell me about working with frat parties, and I also heard that you worked with Jack Ruby, who was, of course, a big figure in the Dallas nightclub scene.
Yeah, we used to play all the frat parties, you know, for all the colleges and sorority parties around town. For years and years, and that's where we kind of learned our craft. And
what was that like? I mean, I've
been to playing all kinds of music, you know, that we love to do Wilson Pickett and James Brown and stuff like that, you know. And I had an hour where I did all hour of the Beatles and all hour of the James Brown show and stuff like that. So we had a lot of college kids growing up that was into the music. As a matter of fact, the first record I cut, a guy was in college and he wanted to cut a record on me. I never made one before, and it was like a regional record, you know, didn't do much. And when I got with Jetstar Abnack, you know, we had John and Robin in the In Crowd and the Five Americans, Western Union, we had that. And those were the only three artists actually that we had on the label initially. And the Jetstar label, I was the only artist on that label, and we really had no promotion. We had one promotion guy that called around on the phone and stuff. That's why a lot of those records never did reach their full potential. All my 45s hit the charts, but they kind of fizzled out because we didn't have the juice to make them grow all the way to the top of what they should be.
But I mean, regionally, I assume you were a big star, yeah?
Oh, yeah, around town, I was the man, you know. And they knew I was qualified, justified, sanctified, and I refused to be denied.
Tell me about white frat kids. No problem playing in the frats?
In the what?
In the fraternity houses?
Oh, no, I had no problem playing in the fraternity houses. We had a ball, you know, playing in the fraternity houses. We did a lot of soul music. They love soul music.
What kind of
like
money?
Say the Wilson Pickett type stuff, Joe Tex and James Brown.
Bobby, what kind of money do you
get? Soul music was really big then, you know?
Yeah, what kind of money do you get for playing in a frat house?
Back in the 60s?
Yeah.
Oh, by the time we split it up with the band and everything, we might end up with $20-$25 a piece.
All right, tell me about Jack Ruby. Right before he shot Lee Harvey Oswald, he was a nightclub owner, right?
Yeah, I was playing for Jack Ruby at the Vegas Club. He had a club called the Vegas Club, and he had another club downtown. But I was playing at the Vegas Club when he killed Oswald. As a matter of fact, I was up to his house to get paid $300. It's all on the report on the internet from the Warren Commission. My testimony is on the internet. They got 8 pages of it. But I went up to his house to get $300 that he owed me the Sunday before he killed Oswald.
Crazy. So after he did that, the FBI came back and wanted to speak with you a little bit?
Oh, they interviewed me twice, man. They got big old testimonies like the phone book on me. You know, they interviewed me twice, the Warren Commission and the FBI. I was very interested because I was up to his house way they found my name is that he had it wrote down on a piece of paper, $300, and they dusted it and found my name and everything. And I could walk up to Jack Ruby's house from where I stayed, you know. So I had walked up there to get my $300. And as I said in the interview, I'm just glad I got paid before he went to jail.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Soul is my music. There's a great best of you out, a 2-CD set on Sunday's label. I'm wondering, when somebody re-releases your music or plays it on the radio, plays the songs you write, do you get any money? Did you have those good deals, or did you have those bad deals back in the 60s?
Bad deal. have a contract with a record company that says that they own the music forever, and I haven't gotten paid for any of that.
Ah, that's horrible, and I hear that story way too often. For years and years, you were, like you said, DJ over at KKDA, 7:30 a.m., until, what happened? That station went Korean or something like that?
Yeah, Harmon sold it to a Korean organization, Koreans, about 2 years ago, and without any warning, you know, he just come and told everybody that the station had been sold.
I'll bet you were a fun DJ. I mean, I can't imagine your show not being a riot.
You know, people are still stopping me everywhere I go. I don't care if it's Walmart or down the street. And they said, oh, I wish you were on the radio again because we had fun. You know, because I wasn't a cookie cutter DJ. You know, I didn't say and do the same things that all the other DJs did. I wanted to make people feel happy in the morning and glad to get up, you know.
Yeah.
So I would say things like, I'm walking on the dirt and the dirt ain't walking on me. And just try to uplift people, and they've missed that. You know, I tell jokes and I tell stories about my days in the record business. And we just had fun. It was a fun show.
Yeah, I can imagine. Let's talk about your clothes. I've seen some photos of you on the internet where you are wearing some really colorful outfits. I'm kind of a square. I wouldn't even know where to begin to get clothes like that. Where do you go and buy, like, a bright red suit?
Well, you know, most of my clothes have some kind of cartoon character on there, you know, Tweety Bird or something like that. I like odd stuff, so wherever I am, if I see something odd, I'll buy it and put it on. You know, I'm not your average 3-score-and-10-year-old person, you know. I figure he chose the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. I am that foolish thing. Don't you worry about the size. Ain't gonna be no compromise. You just watch me rise.
Yeah, you are 70 years old, as you just let the cat out of the bag there. But you certainly have the, it seems like, the energy, the outlook of an ageless person.
Well, I'm just getting started, you know. They got my age on the CD, you know. There was from a writer in Dallas at the Dallas Morning News putting my age in there, and I'm proud of my age because, you know, age ain't nothing but a number. You know, some of these people be ripping and tipping and tapping and making them sexy sounds. In the meantime, in between time, Bobby's down here on the ground.
Tell me, who's the best soul singer who ever lived?
Ooh, that's hard to say because I love people for different reasons. You know, I love the Wilson Pickett's aggressiveness and his grit, you know, and his gospel and his music. I love James Brown's showmanship. And one of my best friends for writing and showmanship in the world was my friend Joe Tex. I love Joe Tex. I love the way he writes, and he was one of the best performers ever in the world. You know, they think that, and people seem to think that James Brown was the best performer on stage, but to me, it was Joe Tex.
Yeah, I'm sorry I never got a chance to see Joe Tex. Yeah, I always heard he was just, his show was fantastic. What about the Beatles? What's your favorite Beatles song?
My favorite Beatles song?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't really have a favorite because I like so much of this stuff. You love me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't remember all of the songs that we used to do, but we used to do the whole catalog, and I just love their writing. Also, you know, when I first went to Europe, I found that the people knew so much about me, especially in Northern England. I was like a legend there because people knew everything about me. They knew things about me I didn't know about myself, my family and everything. You know, every song I wrote and where I wrote it, where I produced it, what time it was recorded. They knew everything, you know. And we used to open up as Bobby Tyson and the Mustangs. We opened up for a lot of British invasion when they came to America. You know, a lot of the artists, we opened up shows for them.
So they got to know you. Yeah, it's funny how sometimes some of our biggest R&B folks are bigger somehow, or they're remembered differently over in the UK than they are over in their own country. It's interesting.
Ooh,
that way.
Oh, man, my reception in Wales and Northern England, Scotland, that area... It's just unbelievable. 4 years ago, I did the whole country of England, London, Manchester, Cricket, St. Thomas, Ickleston, Blackpool. And everywhere I went, I had a different band, and they all knew all my music. And it just floored me how much they knew about Bobby Patterson, you know. And I was like a legend in that part of the world.
That must be fun. Lincoln Center Out of Doors, there's a whole summer festival going on. And there's a lot of great music. And I urge you to check out the whole list of folks. And all the shows are free. LCOutOfDoors.org is the website. And Bobby's show is Sunday, August 10th. And hopefully you'll get some good weather. And that'll be just a beautiful outdoor thing. Tell me what the folks will see at that show. What kind of a show? I don't assume you just stand in one spot and sing a song.
Well, I try not to. It's hard for me to stand in one spot. You know, I come to rock your world like a nut do a squirrel. And I hate to stand in one spot because, you know, back in my earlier days, you know, I did a whole lot of moving around. I still do a whole lot of moving around. And I want people to come to see what I do because I'm just getting started. Like I say, I'm excited to be at the Lincoln Center. It's my first time ever being there. And I'm looking forward to it, yeah, I guarantee you. I'm going to chase lightning and capture thunder, walk through the graveyard and make the dead folk wonder.
It sounds like fun. And let's talk. It really does. I can't imagine this show won't be just a ride. And I do urge everyone to head down there a week from Sunday, August 10th, Lincoln Center Out of Doors. Let's end this with the title track from the new record called I Got More Soul. The great band on this record. Who are these guys?
These guys are from Austin, Texas. Zach Ernest and his group of guys, Matt Scott, and we recorded this at Allen Studios in Austin, Texas, and we had fun doing it. The BBC came in and recorded the whole session and filmed the whole session, and it was just an exciting time. It was a great big studio. You know, so many people are cutting records in the bathroom and in the closet and on the cell phone and all that kind of stuff. We recorded this in a real huge studio, and it was lots of fun, you know.
Yeah.
That was great. You know, Austin is a big music center now, and so many artists live there and everything, that it's a pleasure to be in that area again because it's like an L.A., as far as music is concerned.
Yeah, there's a lot of energy down in Austin, especially for music. Very supportive for music. Yeah, well, like I said, the record sounds great. The band is great. Great selection of mostly original songs on here. And this song's called I Got More Soul. It's out on the Omnivore Recordings label. And Bobby Patterson, just great to talk to you. And we'll see you a week from Sunday down at Lincoln Center, yeah?
Okay, thanks for having me, Michael. I'm looking forward to seeing everybody out there. Thank you very much, okay?
All right, have a great day.
Back at you.
Get the hose for Miss Annie Rose, 'cause she's hotter than a $2 pistol. I know what I'm saying, ain't my first time playing. I used to see your sister Crystal. You can feel cold.